Hello and welcome to the You and You Merit podcast. I'm Howard Hudson and this week I'm joined by Professor Fred Gault. We'll be talking about his new paper on the social impact of the development of science, technology and innovation indicators. Now, the underlying assumption here is that indicators are a kind of technology, a product which governs behaviour and develops in response to user needs. So that's our starting point. Now let's take a closer look. You say that indicators for innovation are not as well developed as those for R&D, but that their development has greater potential for social impact because innovation is not confined to the laboratory, because it's a marketplace phenomenon and has more immediate impact than R&D. This social impact you speak of, Fred, how quickly and strongly might it be felt? How will it be manifested?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's a multi-part question, so I'm going to give you a multi-part answer. The more general question of social impact has two levels. The first is impact on the community of producers of indicators, and the second is impact on the community of users. Common to both is language. Now, indicator development and use is about developing and using a common language that supports both technical and social discourse on the subject and allows it to advance. Now, why do innovation indicators have greater potential for having impact than, say, R&D indicators? Well, we think we understand R&D indicators, and R&D takes place in well-understood R&D units. Our main policy concern is that we do not do enough of it. Now, contrast this with innovation, which is everywhere. In our current thinking, innovation happens in business, and businesses are connected to clients and to suppliers and competitors, and they are motivated and constrained by framework conditions such as intellectual property law, trade regulation, level of education of the workforce, financial services, and incentives. Now, the point is that innovation is a dynamic, complex, nonlinear, and global phenomenon, and it requires a different way of thinking, a systems approach, and a different approach to policy, which you can find discussed in the OECD Innovation Strategy. So, common language, systems thinking, and an imperative to solve social as well as technical problems provides the context in which the impact of indicator development happens.
Could the development of these innovation indicators be used to help poorer countries, for example, to catch up?
Well, yes, indeed, but I am not sure that I would phrase the question in exactly that way. I will give you an example. The new Partnership for Africa's Development, NEPAD, which is a program of the African Union, has been working for the past couple of years doing innovation surveys and R&D surveys in some African countries. And they have had to start from the beginning. They've had to learn the language, they've had to learn how to do a survey, and they now have results and they're about to release the African Innovation Outlook. Now, what is going to come out of this is a better understanding in the participating countries about how their innovation system works or does not work. And they will be able to intervene to fix system failures or market failures or other failures and make their economy run better the way they want it to run.
So it's giving them the tools to understand exactly how to move forward.
That is exactly right.
Okay, you also say that manuals, which generally feed into and define these indicators, are based on codified knowledge, but that we need tacit knowledge to produce and update them. You say the balance between codified knowledge and tacit knowledge presents an ongoing tension, however. And when tacit knowledge dominates, it's time to revise the manual to provide a new platform of accepted codified knowledge and the language that goes with it. Can you give a recent real-world example of this interplay?
Yes, a recent real-world example is the third edition of the Oslo Manual. I should have brought one with me. Well, it can be downloaded from the OECD at no charge if you're desperate to read the Oslo Manual. It took 3 years, long years, to discuss the tacit knowledge that had emerged from a decade of survey experience, and it became clear that the definition had to change to accommodate market development as innovation and industrial organization and use of business practices as innovation. So they were added to the definition, and the definition then included product innovation, goods or services brought to the market, process innovation, industrial organization, and market development, four components. Previously there were two. The systems framework was made more explicit, and a chapter was added on linkages as part of that. These were major steps. The innovation surveys that are partial implementations of the manual are using the third edition now, and more knowledge is being accumulated, and of course, more questions are being asked. Of such questions, an example is public sector innovation, which is very current, given that we are trying to get the public sector to do more with less in most countries as we recover from the financial crisis. And recall that I said that innovation takes place in business because they connect to market. But public sector organizations can do all of the innovation activities. They can do R&D, capital investment, training, knowledge acquisition, design, whatever. But according to the Oslo Manual, they are not innovating, as they are not putting a product on the market or engaging in activities to move the product to market. So this is an example which is being debated at the moment. Why can't the public sector be innovative too? And this may lead to another revision.
We hope.
Okay.
You also say that R&D expenditure was capitalized, in other words, transformed from an expense to an asset in the 2008 System of National Accounts. Now, can you tell us when will these rules be implemented, and when they are enforced, do you think they will encourage greater investment in R&D?
That's a good question. First, we should distinguish national accounting from business accounting, because firms have for years capitalized R&D, which simply means that the investment is seen, or the results of the investment, the benefits, are seen to last longer than a year and can, in principle, be depreciated. Now, we're talking here about an intangible investment, like training of the workforce, but it does share characteristics with the acquisition of machinery and equipment and own account construction, and that is why we think of it as a capital investment. Now, as a capital expenditure, R&D will have an impact on gross domestic product, which it did not have as an expense. And that moves R&D from a peripheral science and technology issue to being integral in the national accounting. And that should, in principle, ensure support for R&D surveys, even in difficult economic times. That is an important thing. This change is happening now, to answer that question, in some countries that have run R&D satellite accounts as part of learning how to deal with capitalization. Other countries will follow as SNA 2008 is implemented across the globe. Now, this is a UN manual, so every country on the planet will eventually capitalize R&D.
So it has a potential to be a global watershed.
Yes.
And not just confined to developed knowledge economies.
Absolutely correct.
Okay, and the European Commission high-level panel suggested two approaches for the development of an innovation indicator. One, a combined indicator based on patents, knowledge-intensive activities, and the contribution of innovative-related trade in manufactured goods to the balance of trading goods. Or two, a single indicator based on the share of fast-growing innovative firms in the economy. Now, which approach do you support and why, or could you suggest a third way, perhaps?
Yes, well, there is a challenge which the Commissioner for Research and Innovation put to the high-level panel. And the Commissioner wanted one headline indicator, like R&D expenditure as a percentage of GDP, which gives us the 3% Lisbon target. And what she got was a composite indicator and the fast-growing firms. Now, the problem, I think, with all of these indicators is that, strictly, they're not indicators of innovation. Patents do not tell you about innovation unless they are connected to the market. And the percentage of employment in knowledge-intensive industries, I think, is a very difficult indicator to link to innovation. Turning to high-growth firms, this ignores large, stable firms growing at a measured pace, but creating a great deal of employment as they go, and focuses perhaps on the small gazelles, which grow rapidly but may expire should they be eaten by a lion, which is the fate of gazelles. So I wouldn't personally choose any of them. And I find it interesting that we are not using indicators from the European Community Innovation Survey, which has been around for 20-odd years and has cost Europeans a great deal of money. So I think there are still questions to answer in order to respond to the Commissioner's request.
You're saying the tools are already there but being ignored, or just not being used properly?
Well, there is a question of why the tools are not being used, and I do not know the answer to that. I wasn't on the high-level panel.
Okay. Many thanks, Fred.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the UNU Merit podcast. If you'd like to hear more about the work of the United Nations University, covering everything from health and entrepreneurship in India, to satellite communications in Africa, to the nuclear disaster in Japan and the revolution sweeping the Arab world, please listen to our other podcasts, or go to www.merit.unu.edu.